Welcome back, everybody. It's time for another episode of OC Spotlight, the one show that talks about the most incredible people doing the most amazing things right here in our own backyard. And this time, well, a personal favorite of mine. We have somebody with us that I've long enjoyed his music, and he's decided to come back into our backyard here in Orange County. He's going to be doing some concerts in San Diego and in up in Beverly Hills soon. Welcome, if you will, the one and only Gino Vannelli. Welcome, sir.
Good to be with you, Paul.
Gino Vannelli, take us on the ride of the last 20 or 30 years. As we were talking offline, I was a disc jockey, young disc jockey in Ann Arbor and then eventually in Virginia, and loved your music. All the sounds of that era, the 70s into the 80s. And then the music business changed dramatically. I got out of radio and lost track of so many artists as times changed, as tastes changed. Take us through that journey. And I want to start with you as a young boy in Canada here with a dream. Your father is a cabaret singer, as I understand, looking at your bio here. And you get inspired by jazz drummers and cabaret singers and classical music. How does that spark turn into the big superstar that you became in the 70s and 80s here?
As a child, I was introduced to a lot of great music. I'll give you this example. A lot of people would say that a Steinway D, you know, was a great sounding piano.
Okay.
Well, when you listen to a Steinway D, whether it be Errol Garner playing it or Oscar Peterson.
You talk in my language here, because I was a big jazz fan, so keep going here.
Yeah, I mean, for me, by the time I was 10 years old, it's not that a Steinway D would sound good, it's just the way a piano should sound. Everything else was less than a piano sound.
Right.
So for me, you know, the great big bands, the great drummers, the great singers, that's the way you're supposed to sing, and that's the way you're supposed to play. My standards were pretty high. I was lucky to have been a drummer in a relief band in a place called the Casaloma at 11 years old in Montreal.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I got to meet Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich and see Stan Kenton live and see Duke Ellington and Ella Fitzgerald and Tony Bennett and real up close, you know, and
yeah,
really took a good close look at their technique, how they breathe, their intonation.
But you're 11. Most kids are out playing baseball. I'm watching Batman, you know, or whatever.
I had my share of that too. But you know, for me, it was really the penchant for aesthetics was just so there. When I was in seventh grade, I was one of the only kids who took the free tickets to go see the Montreal Symphony every Thursday.
They oh my goodness!
Concert for any elementary school kids. So the first time I went, they played Ravel's Daphne and Chloe.
Wow.
And I said to myself, I said, well, I don't know what it is. I can't hear the tonics. I can't hear the fundamentals in it, but it sounds like it's somewhere in the spheres. And so it intrigued me so much, Ravel's writing.
Yeah, right.
Impressionism. And then
I'm familiar with Ravel's Bolero, but I don't remember all of his other compositions here. The one that they use in the movie Ten so famously, yeah, right.
Yeah, all his piano compositions are just amazing. But when another incident was the first time I was introduced to Sunday Mass was when I was 6 or 7 years old, and my parents wanted me to go, and I was born and raised Catholic child, Catholic school, French schools, and all.
We're connecting on another level. I'm still a good Irish Catholic here, so and the church has obviously a rich tradition of music going way back when.
I didn't want to go, and when I walked into the church and 100-piece choirs started singing Panis Angelicus, I got shivers all over my body, and I just said, "Well, I guess God really lives here."
Yeah,
it was the sound of the harmonies, the Gregorian chants.
Yeah, the Gregorian chants.
Organ
yeah.
sounded. It was something, acoustic, something really visceral, you know, something tactile about music that really kind of embraced.
So this touched you in a way that most 6, 7, 8, 10, 11-year-olds didn't. Some of them just wanted to pick up a guitar and be Elvis Presley here, but you had a real deep connection with the music itself.
I did, and I loved the drums, and I was, by the time I was 10 or 11, my father bought me a kit, and a Ludwig kit. I was a lucky kid. By the time I was 12, I started taking piano lessons, and then I took guitar lessons when I was 14. And that really gave me the, having basic knowledge of all the rhythmic or the rhythm section instruments, really started my my arranging, really helped my arranging ability.
Now you I was going to say, somewhere in there you picked up a record contract in Canada, right? Didn't you get a Juno Award, their equivalent of sort of the Grammys or whatever?
Well, that came later. By the time I got out of high school, I got signed to RCA Victor, one of the bigger record companies, and had a sort of mild hit in Canada. It gave me a good taste of the business, and then I asked for my release, and I moved to New York when I was not quite 18. I dropped out of college.
Wow.
I figured I'd pick up my education along the way, and so I read fanatically, and I continued my music theory lessons, you know, with private.
And were your parents supportive of this? Or were you following the dream that your dad had for himself at maybe one point in time? Or were they saying, no, don't go there, this will break your heart here?
My mother was terrified. My father had his fingers crossed.
I like that. All right, so now the story that I got, I'm sure you've told this a million times. It's in your bio. It's in your Wikipedia article. Yes, he has a great Wikipedia page here, folks. Go check it out. I never had heard this story, but I'm going to ask you to retell it quickly one more time here. You come to Hollywood. According to what it says, you're down to your last $5. You're with your brother. And you decide to take a bold move and stand outside the gates of A&M Records over there off of Sunset and try and meet the great, famous Herb Albert. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I have to, you know, preclude it, or at least precede it, you know, with this feeling that I always felt like music was more than just a career or a job. I felt like it was something that was inside of me that had to be brought out.
Yeah, sounds like that.
I always, you know, looked at it a little bit like a mission quest. And after being in L.A. for 4 months and having all the doors, you know, slammed shut in my face, we had to leave the next day, and I didn't want to leave. So I got up early that morning, and I walked along Sunset Boulevard. And I, as the song says, I did stop into a church, and I rested in the pews and fell asleep.
Just like the mamas and papas, California dream in here, right?
Yeah. And I woke up with exactly knowing what I had to do, and I went back to the, at that time it was called the Orange Motel, for $5 a day, and I got my brother up and took my guitar, and I just waited in front of the gates, the Charlie Chaplin studio,
yeah,
where
right.
A&M Records was.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was warned by the guard and all that kind of stuff. And finally, 3-4 hours later, I saw Herb come out of his office and walk across the parking lot. And I said, this is exactly what I saw.
This is the moment, so, yeah.
Yeah, so I dropped my guitar, ran through the gate, was chased, and accosted Herb. And while I was being dragged away by the guard, Herb, I think, had a little mercy in his heart and asked the guard to let me go and asked me what I wanted. I said, just let me sing you a couple of songs. And he said, come back in 30 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
And I sang him, let's see, Mama Coco, Lady, People Gotta Move, Crazy Life, a few songs like that.
Yeah. And all those became big hits for you. Yeah, right.
Well, at least well-known.
Yeah, right.
You know, and he just turned to me and said, well, welcome to the family. And I started recording 3 weeks later. I went back to Montreal. It was Christmas Day.
Isn't this the story that keeps everybody coming? The impossible dream, the down to your last buck, and you literally get in front of the man, and you have 5 minutes, less, 30 seconds to make an impression, and you did.
Yep. Yeah, and but I had worked towards it for 5 years.
Sure.
Because, you see, I started really early, and by the time I was 18, I mean, I was, well, not quite 5 years. I got the deal when I was 21. But every breathing moment, you know, every waking moment, I thought about it, and I tried to improve myself. And by the time I did perform for Herb, I guess I was ready to make an impression.
Yeah, well, and you were prepared for that one moment. You knew you had one shot at this, and you were ready for it.
Yep. And then came the years, the A&M years, which were, you know, tremendous growth years for me. From Crazy Life to Powerful People to, you know, Storm at Sun Up and Just the Gemini, and then ending up, you know, with Brother to Brother. You know, that 6-year period was tremendous growth.
And A&M, let's go back and look at the roster on A&M. This is like, what, the late 70s, somewhere in that period time here?
My first record was 1972, and then Brother to Brother was 1978.
So if I remember correctly from my disc jockey days, A&M was not what record companies are today. They had a very wide sound from Herb's original Tijuana Brass, whatever you want to classify that as, kind of clever, kind of, I'm almost saying muzak or something here, and to the Carpenters, the Carpenters that period of time, I think, and then Gina Vanelli and Rock and Roll Acts and everything in between. I mean, it was a rich environment, it seems like.
Well, they had, a lot of artists that I really, really admired. I mean, including Cass Stevens and Joe Cocker and
right.
the Carpenters, and then Quincy Jones, and George Harrison made a deal with them, and Carole King made a deal with them. And so, I mean, they were really the most famous and the best independent label, you know, in the world at that time. And it was really an honor and privilege, you know, to be.
And they found artists with some. The Carpenters would be a great example. I confess I was a big Carpenters fan too. And in an era when that was kind of could be seen as uncool, this kind of, I mean, she sang so magnificently, but this kind of lush, almost like a throwback to the 40s and 50s kind of music, orchestral kinds of songs. To Joe Cocker, I mean, you know, there's a wide range between those audiences and those styles, but they seem to be able to find artists in niches and develop that in a way that others wouldn't or couldn't. They weren't just bound to a formula.
I remember the first week that I just went to the A&M studios, and of course Herb was producing Crazy Life himself, mm-hmm. and Karen Carpenter was coming in, and she was rolling her drums in. And, you know, I was a bit starstruck with all the great artists going in and out of, you know, A&M Studios.
Right.
And I asked Karen, I said, "Hi, Karen, I'm Gino Vanelli. I just got signed to A&M. She said, "Oh, good to meet you." And I said, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Why are you rolling your own drums? And don't you have people to do that for you?" She said, "Honey, you never stop being a roadie."
I love it. All right, so you're in this rich environment, and you flourish. And describe the music. I don't want to put my own classification on it, but it's not. It was a very lush, to me, a very orchestral kind of sound to this. It wasn't just your typical top 40 pop music, and yet it played on the pop charts. How would you classify? Where does it fit? I know artists hate to do that, but for those who maybe you're younger and are trying to understand what that time was like, what was your music about?
Well, you have to, you know, give the audience a backdrop. And the backdrop was in the 70s. I mean, music was the thing in people's lives.
Oh.
And music was exploding in the sense that music was fusing into all these nuanced styles.
Yeah, right.
People were combining styles and calling it fusion. But, I mean,
The Eagles come out, and there's suddenly country rock, you know, or you've got all sorts of very. It seemed like it started in the late 60s and into the early 70s. You had everything from James Taylor to Chicago and brass bands, you know. It seemed like everything was open at that time.
The last time we had such fusion was in Paris in the 1890s. When
that's
you had the Monets and the Renoirs, you know, and the Chagalls that were actually combining classical art with modernism. And same thing with music. Ravel himself and Debussy, French Impressionism was really a combination of folk music with what later would become jazz, with classical music, with music that was actually regional music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, Ravel would employ a lot of Basque music.
I had no idea that. Okay, now you're educating me here. All right.
So with music in the 70s, you know, we would try our best to employ all these different nuanced genres to mainstream music. For me, it was, yes, of course, some big band, some folk, always lyrically based, a little bit of jazz combo stuff, a little bit of rock stuff, a little bit of R&B stuff, you know, and some stuff that I couldn't really, you know, categorize at all. So it was really always a combination of many musics. Now, I like big band, but I refuse to use ordinary big band sound.
Like, okay.
You know, horn section.
Right.
I wanted to do it with synthesizers, and I wanted to caricaturize a big band sound, and that's what we had in Powerful People and Stormy Sons and Just the Gemini.
And very powerful, layered stuff, almost in a weird, maybe this is a strange comparison, maybe I'm reaching for something, but almost kind of like what Phil Spector did with his Wall of Sound. In simpler times, he tried to make them seem lush and deeper rather than just, you know, three chords and bass drum and a guitar here.
Well, you know, my penchant for harmonic deviance always made it more difficult, you know, to arrange and orchestrate. In those days, you know, there were no such things as polyphonic synthesizers.
No.
It was monophonic. That means you have to play one note at a time. So if you did a horn section or a violin section with 6 to 10 notes, whatever it is, we had to play it once, one note at a time, and then double it, you know, perfectly.
Go back and do it again, exactly. Yeah, right, and then lay on another track here, right.
Yeah, it wasn't that easy, but it gave it a sound.
Yeah.
You know, and it was something unique and special. It was a time for not only, you know, growing, it was a time for a burgeoning time for music, and it was lovely. And the 80s was different. You know, music was tightening up, but as music tightened up, I wanted to open myself up to new influences.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought there were no more influences, you know, in music that I thought, in especially mainstream music, that could really influence me in the way that I wanted to. So I went off into poetry land, and I went off into literature land. I went back to college, and I went off into the humanities and theology.
Oh, my goodness,
and that would subsequently really affect the way I recorded Yonder Tree and subsequent albums.
So during that period of exploration, I'm sorry to try and rush the story, but we got about 5 or 7 minutes left here. During that period of time, you kind of dropped out of public view. The charts changed. We had new wave music and punk and backs. It's almost like they wanted to go back to super simple again here. They didn't want orchestrations. They didn't want lush. They wanted stripped down sounds again here. Did that change your flavor, your quest, or you were just on your own, as you said, mission quest here to find your own voice, your own stories?
Well, I played a little bit of that game, you know, with Black Cars and Hurts to Be in Love and Wild Horses, and we had a reasonable amount of success with it. But I just by the time the late 80s came, I just was not interested in mainstream music anymore. It wasn't interesting to me anymore. People were just trying to hit the bottom line or the lowest common denominator to attract an audience, and that as we talked
trying
about,
to manufacture a hit rather than make music that really came from the artist.
Yeah.
Right.
That's exactly so. So in the late 80s, 90s, I went off into my own thing, and I worked with big orchestras, you know, and even recorded a full-on orchestral, classically-oriented album like Canto. And then I lived for 2 or 3 years in the Netherlands and worked with Dutch musicians and recorded an album called A Good Thing. So I, for people who follow what I do, you know, the cardinal rule was stay interested. If you stay interested, you might be interesting.
There you go. All right, so I got to tell you what interested me when I went to your website. Talk about your interest in singing in other languages. That seems far afield from anything else I could have imagined. And I look at this piece, I don't know when it was recorded, this canto, and it's spectacular. I don't know where it would play today. I don't know what station would run it, except on the internet. There are no stations like us. You know, it's anything and everything. And I'm not trying to just blow smoke at you, but your voice has never been better. Your interpretation, I mean, it just moved me to listen to this piece. And I thought, wow, that's something. Yeah. This guy has still, you know, so often we think, well, the artist is coming back to just recreate their hits and we're going to relive those days again here. You've gone in directions nobody could have followed or imagined, and you're hitting it.
Well, you know, I love doing that. I just recently did a song from the New Wilderness Road album called Road to Redemption. I did that in Spanish with a friend of mine from Argentina, Alejandro Lerner, and it's called El Camino del Perdón, and it was really fun. You know, it's on my Facebook. It's really I really enjoyed singing in Spanish. It's not that easy. If you don't sing in Spanish, it's not that easy.
Do you just phonetically learn the phrases? I would read about pop stars would have to try and record in Japanese or something just because they wanted a foreign language version of their song. And they had no idea what they were saying, but they would have to learn it sort of phonetically.
No, I did it the method actor way. I became it. I studied what the translation was all about, really internalized it. And, of course, Alejandro helped me with the pronunciation, but I knew exactly what I was singing when I was singing it, and that really was the impetus for my singing.
So why sing in foreign languages? It's hard enough to sing.
Because I can do certain things in those languages that I can't do in English.
Like what? What would you say? No. The language has a different sound, it has different meanings, I know there's certain different phrases that don't translate into English.
Well, certain sounds, for instance, in Italian, the vowels are bigger, longer, wider. And in Spanish, there are more intricate consonants. For instance, they're like the song Road to Redemption. The English version, it's a long road to redemption. That's what it is in English.
Okay.
In Spanish, sé que es largo el camino de regreso.
So I don't know why, but that sounds more romantic and lyrical to me. Just I have no idea what you're saying, but just the sound of it in Spanish or Italian.
It's more complex to sing, so you have to really time your consonants and understand the harshness of them and all that kind of stuff. It does make for a beautiful effect, but you have to understand where they come. And that's the challenge for me.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of challenge. I love to sing, but I like to sing things that are meaningful. And I think that's why people still come to see our concerts, because I'm not just running through the hits. Although we do that,
right.
The band is just...
That's the starting point, not the ending point. You're starting with, here's where we were, and here's where I've gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun to do Nightwalker. It's fun to do Brother to Brother in Appaloosa and all that.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, fun for me to pick up the guitar and do yet something beautiful from Wilderness Road, you know. And I mean, music is just more than a sound. It's what lies behind the sound. That is the impetus for the sound. It's the intention behind the sound that really still gets to me on a deep level.
Well, I'll tell you what. I heard your music, which I had not heard. The stuff you're talking about here in some foreign languages, like is it a canto? The piece that's up on your site there, you playing with, I don't know if it's your brother playing on piano or somebody, but...
No, that's El Camino del Perdón. That's with Alejandro Lerner. He did the translation for me in Spanish, but it was certainly a lot of fun.
Wow, it's just...
The video.
Go check it out, everybody. Your website is GINOV.com.
Like, yeah, and just, you know, Vanelli Facebook. You know, we have a bunch of videos on there. I love doing... In fact, we're shooting another video on Monday at a local pool hall, and it's a video called Older and Wiser from the new record, and it's going to be a lot of fun doing it.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a crazy pool hall. We've got some great pool sharks in the video.
We're going to end with another common theme here, the sounds that you work into stuff. I'm going to tell you a quick story here, and then we'll end the piece here. For many years, you wouldn't know this, I went from being a DJ to being an entertainment publicist. I handled Johnny Mathis and Anthony Quinn, a whole bunch of people. And then I somehow stumbled into the world of billiards. And I produced in 1987 one of the biggest billiard tournaments ever put on. It was here in Los Angeles at the Biltmore. And went on and produced the World Nine Ball Championship and met all these great guys from the old Steve Mizorak up to the modern era. How I fell into that's a long story. But we were doing a promo piece in Louisville, Kentucky, and we're on the radio talking about a tournament that's coming up, and somebody called in and said, I love pool. And so we're chatting with them and everything, and halfway through the caller's call, it turned out that they were blind. And I said incredulously, you like pool, but you're blind? They said, I just love the sound of the balls clacking together. So I hope you will work some of those sounds in. It is a magical... When we would do events, somebody would start breaking the balls, and a crowd would gather. we wouldn't do anything. Just the sound of that's an attractive sound. So I challenge you to think about how you can incorporate some of that into your music, because I think you'll find it's amazing.
I'm going to use a lot of the breaking of the balls to accentuate some of the, you know, the punctuations in the music.
Right. Yeah, why not? Well, what a fascinating story, sir. And I welcome. Let's give everybody a plug here, because there's a chance to come and see Gino Vannelli. I take it you don't come through town very often here. I don't know how often you tour or where you tour, but you're going to be Friday, October 11th at Amici. Did I say that right? Amici Park down in San Diego.
Yep.
Friend Park. And then the very next day, Saturday, October 12th, at the wonderful Saban Theater up in Beverly Hills. If you've never been there, I think it's on Wilshire or something? I've forgotten exactly where it is.
It's a beautiful theater,
Beautiful old world theater that they've many years ago turned into a concert venue here. And tickets are, I think, are the VIP tickets I know are sold out in Amici Park, but I think there's still tickets available for the Saban. Well, there's tickets available for both shows, but if you want to get front row like I would certainly want to do here, you're going to want to get up close. What a journey. Any idea where the journey goes, or do you just follow the muse wherever it takes you?
Well, it's partly following the muse, but, you know, I'm working on a libretto, an opera, and I'm working on a fictional book, and I'm also working on 30 other songs, you know, for another record, and we're working on doing an Australian tour next year and doing a big band tour, actually, in New Zealand.
Oh, I would love to see you do a big band tour, because I think with your orchestral sense and you seem to like big pieces of music here that have lots of movement and lots of pieces and lots of sound to them here.
Yeah, that would be fun. I mean, I've never been to New Zealand, and touring seven cities in New Zealand with a big band will be a lot of fun.
Well, Gino Vannelli, it has been absolutely an honor, a privilege to reconnect with your music and to hear how you have progressed since the 70s when we both sort of fell in love with music, you performing, me listening to it and trying to play it for others here. And I wish you all the best, and let's plug those dates again. Friday, October 11th, a rare chance to see Gino Vannelli in person, not just doing the hits, folks, but he's going to take you, if you're open to it, he's going to take you on a journey of places and spaces that you wouldn't imagine here as his music continues to grow and go in different directions. Amici Park in San Diego and Saturday, October 12th at the Saban Theater in Beverly Hills. And I believe we're going to be giving away some pair of tickets to each of those locations. So check our social media as well. And thank you so much for joining us here.
It's been my pleasure, Paul.
You've been listening to another example of OC Spotlight, taking a look at the most incredible people doing the most amazing things right here in your own backyard.